from Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made. Appreciate you being with us on the Bishop's Hour. And I should tell you that the Feast of the Holy Innocents, Candlelight Procession, and Mass, Friday, December 28th, Bishop Soto will lead the procession. It's the annual Feast of the Holy Innocents, Candlelight Rosary Procession, and Holy Mass. Everyone is invited to meet at 6 p.m. on the steps of the Cathedral of the Blessed Sacrament. If you have never been there, it's at 11th and K, right in downtown Sacramento, to pray for the sanctity of life. Everyone will walk to Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish at 7th and T, about a mile, three-quarters of a mile, something like that. A nice walk, beautiful area downtown, and the concelebrated Mass will begin at 7 p.m. This March for Life commemorates those male infants of Bethlehem who were killed by decree of King Herod, as well as those innocent unborn babies lost today by abortion. You're invited to bring your family, bring the kids, sing with St. Mary's Choir, and walk the Holy Mass praying the Rosary. Candles will be provided. Carpools will then shuttle people back to where they parked. You obviously dress warmly, bring umbrellas if needed, and wear your walking shoes. Yeah, you are going to Mass, but by the same time, wear something that you're comfortable walking in and something that you're going to be comfortable, because it's, whether it's raining or not raining, it'll certainly be chilly. For more information on this, contact Letitia Hilbert. Letitia is at 916-519-0417. That's the Feast of the Holy Innocents, Friday, December 28th. Gather at the cathedral at 6 p.m. And if you can't make the walk, you can still go to Holy Mass at Our Lady of Guadalupe at 7th and T, beginning at the concelebrated Mass at 7 p.m. That's December 28th. James Cavanaugh, the director of the Office of Worship and Prayer, joins us.
Good morning.
Good to have you with us as we head toward the third Sunday of Advent.
That's right. Yep. It's getting close now.
Yeah, when we were kids, we were talking off air here, we weren't quite sure. We knew Lent, 40 days on the desert, and 40 days, 40, 40, 40, 40. That's big in the Catholic Church. We understood it. We had to give up chocolate.
That's right.
Advent, we were a little so it was like, with all due respect, a poor man's Lent. I think my dad said that one time. I thought, what does that mean, a poor man's Lent?
Yeah.
We weren't quite sure. We would always compare it as kids. We would compare it to Lent.
Yeah.
Are we giving something up? What about that Advent calendar with a little chocolate behind it?
Yeah, that's right. Well, there's a certain truth in what you're saying, that Advent is traditionally a sort of little Lent. Mm-hmm. It is somewhat penitential in character, uh-huh. Hence the purple color.
Right.
The purple colors of the vestments, the purple colors that adorn the altar,
right.
And of course the purple candles of the Advent wreath, right. All denote penitence or penance.
Right.
And so it does have that kind of subdued penitential mm-hmm. character mm-hmm. similar to Lent. And in fact, centuries ago, the season leading up to Christmas was like Lent, 40 days. And it began the day after the feast of St. Martin of Tours, who mm-hmm. died in the late 4th century and was a very popular saint in the early church. And so from they marked, of course, the date of Christmas back 40 days.
Yeah.
And it fell on the feast of St. Martin of Tours. And so they called it the St. Martin's Lent.
St. Martin's Lent.
St. Martin's Lent for many, many centuries. And it was the 40 days leading up to Christmas.
So we're dealing with around the 5th of November?
The 11th of November. The 11th of November is actually St. Martin's feast day. And then the next day, this St. Martin's Lent would begin.
That's and it was also Armistice Day, if I'm not.
That's true, but that comes a little bit later.
A little bit later.
A little bit later.
What, 1918, 1919?
But a lot of it, of course, you know, hinges on the fact that Christmas falls on December 25th. So, right. Of course, some people, you know, question, well, how did they decide on that date? Because unlike Easter, when, you know, the resurrection of Jesus was clearly known from the very first mm-hmm. day, because it coincides with Passover, no one knows for sure exactly when Christ was born. So, very early in the church's life, they decided on a date in which to commemorate his birth.
Wow.
And so December 25th was chosen to commemorate his birth. And, you know, there's a lot of debate and speculation and arguments about
that. A lot of argument about it. I heard the first time I heard somebody say that, like, well, you know, it might not have actually been December 25th. I was devastated. I was like, what?
Yeah. So, you know, some have speculated that it would have possibly been in the fall, a little earlier in the fall, to coincide with the Jewish Feast of Booths, mm-hmm. which there were three festivals in the Jewish calendar in which the men of Judy of the Jewish faith were required to go to Jerusalem to for their pilgrimage mm-hmm. and to observe these feasts at the temple. And the three were Sukkot, or the Feast of Pentecost, Feast of Booths in the fall, and of course Passover. So those three, one takes place in the spring at Pentecost, and then one takes place in the fall, Feast of Booths. So some have speculated that because these were the few times in the year when masses of Jews would be congregated mm-hmm. in Jerusalem, that it would have been the most opportune time for Caesar mm-hmm. to take his census.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if there's any like historical credibility to that, but it's sort of an interesting notion to think of, because we know that from Luke's account that Jesus was born during this during a time when a big census was mm-hmm. taken. So it could have been during one of those major festivals when there would have been a lot of Jews in and around Jerusalem. And as we know also from Luke's account, there was no room for them in the inn,
right.
which would also sort of suggest, you know, a time when there were a lot of pilgrims in and around Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But December 25th was settled on by the church, and actually very, very early in the church, the first recorded date of Christmas being celebrated on the 25th was in the year 336. And that was established by the Emperor Constantine. So, you know, as you may remember from your history, it was just a few years earlier that Constantine legalized Christianity in 313.
Right.
Prior to that, Christianity was illegal and it was an underground religion. But in 313, Constantine legalized Christianity, and so from that time on, it began to flourish.
So were people celebrating Christmas on another day prior to that, or really not celebrating
well,
at all
we don't
because
really
they
know.
Were more underground?
We don't really know for sure, because the church was underground, the commemorations and the liturgical aspects of the church were not as well known as they would be after Christianity becomes legal. However, you know, one would have to then question, well, why would Constantine have authorized or established the 25th as the feast day if there had not already been some precedent for it?
Sure.
So, you know, that's one thought. In Rome, as many of your listeners know, there were important pagan festivals that took place around this time of year, most particularly the feast called Saturnalia. In Latin, it was called Dies Natalis Solis Invicti, the day or the birthday of the invincible sun, the birthday of the invincible sun, S-U-N. And, right. And the idea here was it was associated with the winter solstice. So as they observe the winter solstice, which occurs a few days earlier, the 21st, they notice that that a few days later the sun begins to climb again in the in the horizon.
The days get longer.
The days start to get longer. And so The
invincible sun, though, with a U.
Exactly.
It's the play on words there.
The
is...
birthday of the invincible sun. And so it would stand to reason that Constantine would, in a sense, replace that feast with the birthday of the real invincible sun.
Yeah, all you had to do is change the one letter.
That's right.
And the rest of it could stay, the birthday of invincible.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's all kinds of speculations as to why that particular date was chosen. You know, it's clearly part of the Catholic Church's history that whenever it entered into a territory that was non-Christian, it didn't seek to like abolish those traditional festivals that the pagans had celebrated,
right.
but in a sense to christen them, to baptize them,
sure.
and to make them Christian.
Right.
And so it's very probable, in my mind at any rate, that the date was chosen with that in mind.
You know, it's amazing. How could the church... How could any organization, especially if it were just man-made and not divinely guided, survive its first 300 years plus of existence underground?
Yeah.
And still be around now 1,700 more years later?
Yeah, that's right.
I don't think it's just not possible.
Yeah, you know, there's been periods of time when the surrounding authorities sought to kill.
Yeah, I mean,
the
it's one thing, you know. I mean, I know people that believe things that I think are kind of weird, you know, but nobody's putting them to death.
Yeah.
You know, they're free to believe whatever they want to as
right.
long as they're not harming people.
That's right.
You know, but with this belief, people were being put to death and it still survived.
Yeah, that's right. And of course, you know, the old saying coined by Tertullian, you know, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church.
Amen.
And so it was almost as if the more the church was persecuted, the more it grew. And we see that even in places today, you know, where the church is persecuted, the faith is thriving. And where the church is tolerated, or like as in America, that... You know, where it's perfectly legal to practice your faith and there's no active persecution, then people become lukewarm in their faith. And,
it's the opposite of what it should be, what you would think it would be.
Yeah.
Human nature being what it is. And I know you read about the saints and you read about the martyrs and you read about people like Maximilian Kolbe and people like that. It was much more modern, obviously. And you think, do I have that in me?
Yeah.
Would I have that in me if I were faced with that?
Yeah.
I mean, nobody, I go to St. James and Davis. You know, I either walk or, you know, we drive and park 20 feet from the front door. There are no police there. You know, there's no, we're not sneaking into the basement and,
right.
you know, doing it by candlelight. It's all out in the open and... You know, I'm not universally embraced by everybody in town for being Catholic, but nobody gives me any grief about it.
Yeah.
And nobody's suggesting I be put on trial.
Yeah.
You know.
Let alone thrown to the lions.
Exactly. You know, and you go, wow. And yet, just as you said, that leads to lukewarmness.
Yeah. That's the big danger that we face is the secularization of Christianity and being kind of absorbed by the ambient culture. Our day is really probably more similar to the period of time when the Greeks occupied Palestine. This story is told in the books of the Maccabees. Mm-hmm. Because historically, whenever a foreign power conquered the Jews, the Assyrians, for example, when they conquered the northern kingdom, Israel, they simply dispersed mm-hmm. all of the inhabitants throughout the world, and so they became lost to history. They effectively purged that whole territory of the majority of the Jews, especially the influential leading Jews,
right.
and they became absorbed in the countries surrounding Israel. And then a few centuries later, when the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem, they sent the Jews into exile, but they didn't scatter them throughout the world. They took them en masse to Babylon, and there they were able to preserve their culture and their identity mm-hmm. In exile. And that's where really the synagogue develops, and the emphasis on the Word of God develops is during that time in exile. And it's when so many of the books of the Bible really become, of the Old Testament, come together. It's during that period of time in the Babylonian exile. So the Babylonians, unlike the Assyrians, didn't disperse the Jews throughout the world and effectively eradicate them, but they retained their own sort of communal identity. And so when the Persians arose and allowed the Jews to return to Jerusalem, there was already an intact community mm-hmm. that could go back and rebuild the temple, rebuild the city, and reestablish their religious practices. The Greeks had a different strategy. They came into Palestine and occupied Palestine, but they didn't disperse the Jews throughout the world and eradicate them that way. They didn't round them up and take them off into exile. They said effectively to the Jews, no, you can stay here, but you're going to have to adopt our ways, mm-hmm. the Greek ways. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, you know, and their persecution was pretty ruthless. You know, you read the accounts in the book of Maccabees, and the Greeks were bloody in their oppression of the Jews. But their whole goal was that the Jews, they were allowed to stay, mm-hmm. but they had to become
right.
like the dominant culture.
Right.
They had
right.
to adopt Greek beliefs and practices.
Assimilate. Yeah.
They had to assimilate into the Greek culture. Mm. And so in some ways, our own time is probably more like that, mm-hmm. where, you know, effectively the secular culture that surrounds us tolerates the church, says, okay, well, fine, you can have your church there in Davis, you can
right.
go to church, but as far as your beliefs and your practices,
right.
you... You have to adopt our ways.
Right.
You know, we see that in some of the court cases, you
oh,
know,
sure.
like the Little Sisters of the Poor.
Absolutely.
That were compelled by the government to provide something that violated their religious beliefs and conscience.
Right.
And, of course, they sued and successfully won their case finally
right.
after years of contest. But the point is that you had the state seeking to impose a particular set of beliefs
yeah.
on the Little Sisters of the Poor in this case.
And people are stunned when they hear this, but in the 1920s, which is less than 100 years ago, in the great state of Oregon, they banned Catholic schools.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. You think, not on the West Coast, not
yeah.
in liberal Oregon,
yeah.
you know. Banned Catholic schools.
Huh.
There was a very active Klan up there, but the governor was 80 behind it.
Huh.
You know, and it was very similar to the Little Sisters of the Poor versus the federal government. It was something like the Sisters of Joseph and Mary versus, and it was the governor's name. You know, and you think, you're never going to win that, Governor. It's like if I were an attorney on the government side and saw the Little Sisters of the Poor versus, I'd say, oh, boy, I'm on the wrong side of this one.
Yeah.
You're never going to beat the Little Sisters of the Poor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe yeah. in football. but not in court.
That's right. Yeah, so the, you know, the whole history of Christianity, well, and even going back before that amongst the Jews themselves, as we hear in the Bible, you know, has been this this tug of war or this contest between worldly powers and the powers of God, the power of God in the world. And we see that really reach its climax in Jesus's trial when he stands before Pilate. And you see there the representatives of two different kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And so the question then becomes, which one are you going to serve? Are you going to serve Caesar or are you going to serve Christ? And so that question, which was posed to the Jews of Jesus' own day, is posed to Christians in every age. Who are you going to serve? Are you going to serve God, or are you going to serve the secular realm, the secular powers, and the secular values, and all the things that dominate our culture? And so we come to a holiday like Christmas, which, of course, as you know, so surprising to see that how politicized even a benign holiday like Christmas can be. Yeah. You know, it sort of ebbs and flows each year, it seems like. But you know, when you and I were growing up, the whole notion of it, you know, having any kind of political ramifications.
None
at all. Yeah. It was just a happy holiday,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
You know, people
didn't have to go to school.
Yeah. but of course, that's not the case so much today. You know, there are times and places and peoples who would want to suppress or at least marginalize the Christmas spirit, the Christmas holidays.
Every year there's the debate, can you have the manger scene on the grass of the state capitol or the steps of the state capitol?
Right.
I remember there was a case, the airport in Seattle, SeaTac Airport in Seattle, put up Christmas trees just to decorate, to make it festive, you know? Oh, and that went to court, you know? And I mean, there are people that are just ready to pounce on it. And I go, well, wait a minute, you know? And then there are people who, you know, you wish them a Merry Christmas, and, I don't celebrate Christmas. We don't do that. Okay, happy solstice, you know, whatever, you know. But if somebody said to me, happy Hanukkah, I'd say, well, thank you. Thank you, and happy Hanukkah to you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but it's not Jews against Christians. It's usually somebody who's an atheist or a non-believer or somebody who's fallen away from the church and is angry.
Yeah.
You know, and you think, well, okay, but Merry Christmas is okay.
Yeah.
But then there are people that get so righteous about it. You know, oh, I was in Macy's and they weren't, or whatever, you know, and then the next year Macy's has got Merry Christmas. And I imagine as marketing people, because Christmas is such a big deal, that they don't know what to do. You know, how can we sell more stuff?
Yeah,
you know?
That's their bottom line.
That's their bottom line.
Yeah. Yeah. So, we're in this Advent season. And, you know, as we started out this segment talking, that originally it was a kind of little Lent. Mm-hmm. It was meant to be more subdued in character and somewhat penitential in nature. And so that's reflected, you know, in each of the Sundays of Lent. I got an email not too long ago asking about the different themes or names of the particular Sundays of Lent. And so, again, I had to do a little homework myself to see what I could learn. Of course, the third Sunday of Lent, which is coming up, most of your listeners know, is referred to as Gaudete Sunday.
G-A-U-D-E-T-E?
Yep. Yeah. It's the imperative, rejoice. And it comes from the introit, or the entrance antiphon, for the third Sunday of Advent. And that introit, or entrance antiphon, is something that's been part of the church's liturgy for centuries. Mm-hmm. And it comes from Paul's letter to the Philippians, mm-hmm. chapter 4, which happens also to be the second reading for this Sunday. So we hear it Well, hopefully we hear it once at the entrance antiphon, and then we hear it again in the second reading. But it's, you know, rejoice, again I say rejoice. And so the theme of joy is pronounced on the third Sunday of Advent. And in the first reading, it's also this theme of joy is also there. It's from the prophet Zephaniah, and it begins saying, "Shout for joy, O daughter Zion. Sing joyfully, O Israel." So you have it in the introit, you know, rejoice, I say to you, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice in the entrance antiphon. And then you hear it again in the first reading. And then in the psalm, the refrain is, "Cry out with joy and gladness, for among you is the great and holy one of Israel." Mm-hmm. Then we have the second reading, rejoice, from Paul's letter to the Philippians, rejoice in the Lord always. And then finally in the gospel, which of course on the second and third Sunday of Advent really zeroes in on the person of John the Baptist. Mm-hmm. And there it concludes, the gospel concludes saying, "Now the people were filled with expectation." Mm-hmm. And, you know, we talked about this earlier about how when we end one liturgical year and begin the new liturgical year, the emphasis is on the second coming of Christ.
Right.
In all his power and majesty, in a way that sort of instills sort of a sense of fear and trepidation,
right.
You know, that the judge is coming, that he will come, as we say in the creed, he will come again to judge the living and the dead. So there's sort of this sense of a fear, you know, mm-hmm. an apprehension surrounding the coming of Christ. But as we move through Advent, that those feelings of fear and apprehension are replaced by joy and expectation. And that's what we hear in this gospel from Luke chapter 3. Now the people were filled with expectation.
So gaudete, where does it come from?
Well, it comes from, it's the Latin word, rejoice.
Just straight out.
Straight out. It's the imperative, rejoice. And like I said, it comes from Paul's letter to the Philippians chapter 4, where he says, rejoice.
I'm going to test that out on my wife, who took 4 years of Latin in high school.
Yeah.
And is not sure why.
Yeah. 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 And it corresponds to, you know, we talked about how Advent being a kind of little Lent, and how earlier it was an actual 40-day season,
right.
Called St. Martin's Lent, right. Or St. Martin's Fast, right. Which was 40 days leading up to Christmas. And so that as you got closer to it, then the Sunday in the middle of Advent,
right.
4 weeks of Advent now, and that middle Sunday, the third Sunday of Advent, is a kind of reprieve from the strict abstinence and penitence that would characterize the season. And so that would be denoted by this theme of joy, and then represented liturgically by the rose-colored vestments, mm-hmm. and the rose-colored candle. It's not pink. It's rose-colored. It's rose-colored, which is meant to evoke this sense of hope,
right?
Hope and joy. It's a joyful color.
We're with James Cavanaugh, the director of the Office of Worship and Prayer. You're listening to the Bishop's Hour. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back right after this. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2425. 2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates.
Good morning. This is Sister Maria, and I'm the Formation Director for the Seminarians, and you are listening to the Bishop's Hour with Bob Dunning.
It's me. Welcome back. We're with James Kavanaugh. We're having this great theological discussion during the two-minute break.
That's right.
Which, when does Lent end?
That's right. Yeah. And so the debate is whether Lent ends at Easter or whether it ends at the, you know, right before the Triduum.
Which starts with Holy Thursday.
Which would make sense because, you know, it starts on Ash Wednesday. Yeah. And it would just stand to reason that it would end on a Wednesday.
And midnight. Yeah.
And in fact, when you look at the liturgy, you know, the change of the liturgical colors is a way of marking time for us in the church. That's one reason why we have these liturgical colors, to help us mark the passage of time. Mm-hmm. And during Holy Week, the color remains purple through Wednesday, but then starting Holy Thursday, the colors change. Holy Thursday is white, mm-hmm. and then Friday is red,
right.
and then of course Easter is white. Mm-hmm. So it stands to reason that the 40 days of Lent begin on Ash Wednesday
and end on Wednesday.
Yeah. So
you'll get emails if it's not.
I know. Well, I anxiously await your listeners' emails.
jkavanaugh@scd.org.
That's right. Know you.
That's right.
Yeah. Feel free to email me with your questions. I enjoy researching these things and trying to find an answer to people's questions.
Well, you mentioned the word synagogue. Where's that word come from?
Well, the prefix of that word, sins, or refers to together.
S-Y-N.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And goji is like the comes from the Greek word from which we get other O-G words like geology or theology or mystagogy. And it's the study of. So, so the synagogue was the place where the Jews would gather together to study God's word. Mm. You know, they would assemble together. And so the synagogue really revolved around scripture and the reading and the discussion and the study of sacred scripture. The temple was the place of sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And so you can see how in the church, these two things, the temple, which was in ancient Judaism, there was simply one place of sacrifice, and that was in the temple at Jerusalem. But there were many synagogues, mm-hmm. as we hear from Luke's account, where Jesus, when he was in his hometown of Capernaum, went into the synagogue. and read from the scriptures and then preached on the scriptures. So there were many, many, many synagogues throughout the land, mm-hmm. and even far beyond it. But there was only one temple, only one place of sacrifice. So in the church, that then those two ideas come together, and that's where we get the liturgy of the word, mm-hmm. you know, the first part of the Mass, and then the liturgy of the Eucharist in the second part of the Mass, the liturgy, the Eucharist, which is a recapitulation of the sacrifice of our Lord. And so those two things are preserved within the liturgical practice of the Catholic Church.
Wow.
Yeah. So we were talking about how the third Sunday of Advent is called Gaudete Sunday, which means rejoice, mm-hmm. and it corresponds to the fourth Sunday of Lent, which is called Laetare Sunday, also denoted by the rose-colored vestments and there's no candles at that time, but the rose-colored vestments, right. and altar coverings and things like that. And again, that rose color, or people call it pink or mauve, or I prefer rose-colored vestments.
And the rose, we think of the Blessed Mother, too.
Exactly. And it's meant to signify this sort of brief respite from the Lenten discipline, mm-hmm. of fasting and prayer and penance and so forth. And so the whole day, that day has a more joyful character. And so indeed we find that just as with Gaudete Sunday, which comes from Paul's letter to the Philippians chapter 4, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice. And on the fourth Sunday of Lent, the entrance antiphon comes from Isaiah 66, and it again has this theme of joy. It says, rejoice, Jerusalem, and all who love her. Be joyful, all who are mourning. Exult and be satisfied. So, again, that theme of joy is pronounced there at the halfway mark through Lent, just as joy is the theme, mm-hmm. as we're halfway through the Advent season, about ready to celebrate Christmas. But it's interesting, you know, so the third Sunday of Advent is characterized by joy, and we might give it a theme, the name of joy for that particular Sunday. But the other Sundays of Advent also, according to tradition, have their own sort of particular themes. Again, this comes from a fellow Catholic here in the diocese emailing me a question about, you know, what are the different Sundays of Advent called? Hmm. We know about the third Sunday,
sure.
of Advent, Gaudete Sunday, joy. But what about the other Sundays? Well, I had to find out.
Wow.
Then here's what
where
I found.
Well, okay, you have a question like that. Mm-hmm. Where do you look first?
Well, this particular answer came to me from the Catholic Company. So there's also Catholic Answers. And,
sure.
I hate to say it, but a lot of times I just, you know, Google it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know,
you
get hundreds of answers.
Yeah.
And I always look for the ones that, like, either Catholic Encyclopedia is always very, very good. It's got a lot of information in there, so you have to kind of sift through it to really get what you want. Other sites like Catholic Answers, or in this case, Catholic Company, their answers are maybe not as thorough, but they give you kind of a quick thumbnail sketch.
Is Catholic Company, is it a company?
Yeah, they sell products and so forth, but they also have articles, mm-hmm. and things like that. In fact, this article had to do with the Advent wreath. And so each Sunday, according to their tradition that they cite here, each Sunday of Advent has its own particular note or character. And so they say that the first Sunday of Advent symbolizes hope. Hmm. And the first candle that's lit is called, they say, the prophet's candle. because during that first week we hear the prophecy of Isaiah,
right,
reminding us of the coming of the Messiah. So the first Sunday of Advent is characterized by hope. The second Sunday of Advent is characterized by faith, and they say that the second candle is called the Bethlehem candle, reminding us of Mary and Joseph's journey to Bethlehem. Mm. And then the third Sunday, we've already discussed joy, and they call the candle, the rose-colored candle, the shepherd's candle, reminding us of the joy that the shepherds experienced as they discovered Christ, and the cry of the angels, you know, glory to God in the highest and peace to his people on earth. And then the fourth Sunday of Advent, they say, the theme is peace. And that candle, they say, is called the angel's candle, reminding us of the message of the angels who appeared just, you know, at Christ's birth. So I don't know how historically reliable.
Or are they selling candles?
Exactly. I don't know how historically reliable it is. Certainly the third Sunday of Advent being, you know, Gaudete, that goes back a long ways.
Yes.
But the other Sundays, hope, faith, and peace, I don't know how, you know, historically reliable those are, but still they're beautiful sentiments.
Yeah, sure they are.
Beautiful sentiments.
Sure they are.
And, you know, when you think about the Advent wreath as being really a devotional instrument that would be used more in the home, you know, than even so in the church. Obviously,
right,
our churches have an Advent wreath.
Right.
Most, I have never seen a Catholic church without an Advent
right.
wreath. but our homes are meant to be adorned with this Advent wreath as a way for families to increase their devotional life in the season
right.
leading up to Christmas. So certainly from that standpoint, as just a devotional device, instilling these ideas of hope, faith, joy, and peace during the Advent season is obviously commendable.
So we associate joy to the world with Christmas Day.
Right, right.
Or should we be singing it this Sunday?
Well,
it's joy.
It's joy, but there's a difference in that popular hymn, Joy to the World, the verse is, Joy to the World, the Lord
is
come.
Is
here. He's here.
It's odd grammar.
Right.
The Lord is come.
Yeah. Whereas the on Gaudete Sunday,
you're still anticipating.
It's the joy of anticipation.
Right.
It's the joy of anticipation.
So sing Joy to the World, we'd have to change the words a little bit.
That's right. Yeah.
The Lord is coming.
The Lord is coming, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, you think about the little kid that's sees his little packages under the Christmas tree, and he looks at all the labels and says, oh, which ones are for me?
Yeah.
Which one's for me? And he maybe picks them up and rattles them and sees, you know, it's that sense of joy of anticipation.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the mother who is about to give birth and she's big and the baby's moving.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the baby's almost here. And so there's a great sense of joy and anticipation about, you know, it could be any day now.
Right.
Yeah. So it's that sort of joy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The joy of anticipation versus the joy of arrival. They're both, you know, moments of joy, but expressed or experienced in different ways.
Do other Christian denominations recognize Advent?
Well, you know, some of the newer Protestant groups, and of course there's so many of them, it's really hard to generalize and even unfair to generalize because there are so many of them. But some, like the Jehovah's Witnesses, of course, they don't even recognize Christmas because they don't believe that you can identify a date on which Christ was born.
So and just what we discussed earlier.
Exactly.
But not any lack of belief in the birth of Christ.
No, but certainly not commemorating it in a particular way. So, you know, it's really hard to generalize about what Protestants believe because it's such a diverse set of beliefs, you know, amongst the Protestant community. But certainly some of the more mainline Protestant churches, like the Episcopal Church or the Lutheran Church, you know, they've retained a lot of the Catholic traditions, such as the Advent wreath and the season of Advent and all the rest of it. So, yeah, so there's definitely some Protestant churches that do observe Advent and some that don't.
We have had a very small remodel on my house years ago, and the contractor was a Jehovah's Witness. I accused him of the insulation on the walls of being a whole bunch of watchtowers. but we ended up having a lot of discussions, and I really appreciated him. And he told me about a project that they were going to do in the little town of Yolo, which is just north of Woodland. It's still in Yolo County. There was a bare piece of ground, about an acre, 2 acres, right off of Interstate 5. And from, I believe it was Friday morning to Sunday night, they took that bare piece of ground and they built a church.
Wow.
Parking lot paved, striped, church completely done, all the plumbing, all the electrical, and they got every Jehovah's Witnesses. I made the mistake of saying Jehovah's to them. He says, "We're not Jehovah's, we're witnesses." Yeah, of course you are, that's right. And they got all the contractors together, and they got all their permits ahead of time and everything. Boom.
Wow.
I guess all the inspectors to come out, you know, like, okay, you know, we're all busy. We can, you know, this is all volunteer we're doing here.
Yeah.
You know, all the labor, all the materials, everything. But you know how it is with the authorities, you know, well, we can't let you do this until we've checked off this, and George can't come out for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And it sits. They got it all. You can still see it. It's a beautiful church.
Wow. That's impressive.
Yeah. In 1 weekend.
Wow. That's impressive.
You want a church built, call them.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's, we were talking too about how the, particularly the second and third Sunday of Advent really zero in on John the Baptist, who, of course, is a transitional figure. He's like the bridge between the Old Testament and the New Testament, and is regarded in many ways as the last of the Old Testament prophets. Mm-hmm. And so John the Baptist is particularly prominent. But what is particularly interesting in my mind about this character and the different narratives in the four different gospels where John is featured in preparing for the Messiah, preparing for Christ, is this this whole idea that, you know, he's baptizing in order to prepare the people for the coming of the Christ, so that they are spiritually ready to receive him when he comes. As we mentioned, the gospel for this coming Sunday concludes, "Now the people were filled with expectation." And it goes on to say, "And all were asking in their hearts whether John might be the Christ." So, and then, you know, he doesn't say so in this particular passage, but we know in other passages he says, you know, "I am not the Christ," mm-hmm. but rather "I am the one, you know, I am the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord." But one of the things that struck me is there's a verse in one of the Gospels, and it only appears in one of the Gospels, where John says, "I baptize you with water, but he who is mightier than I is coming, the thong of whose sandals I am not worthy to untie." And then goes on to say, "Among you stands one whom you do not know." And that phrase only appears in one of the Gospels. Do you happen to know which one it is?
Mm-mm. It's either Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John.
That's right. Yeah, it's one of those four. No, it's the Gospel of John, which surprised me.
I was going to say that.
Yeah, which actually surprised me. But yeah, there in John chapter 1, It says they had been sent from the Pharisees, and they asked him, "Why are you baptizing if you are neither the Christ nor Elijah nor the prophet?" John answered them, "I baptize with water, but among you stands one whom you do not know, even he who comes after me, the thong of whose sandal I am not worthy to untie." So that last part, that last phrase, the thong of whose sandal,
which is a very famous phrase,
and is common in the other gospels, but it's that little addition: there is one among you whom you do not know, and that's the phrase I really wanted to zero in on, because as we get close now to Christmas on this third Sunday of Advent, which is characterized by joy, is this idea that this Christ who is to come is so close, is so near, that he's right here among you, mm-hmm. and you do not even recognize him. You don't even recognize him. And, you know, that's a very sobering thought for us as Catholics. You know, are we the ones, when we go to Mass, do we not recognize Christ standing right next to us? And when we leave church, of course, those words even have a more poignant ring. There is one standing among you whom you do not know. And that, you know, sort of takes us back to this idea of that the Lord is coming, the Lord who will judge the living and the dead. Because we, from Matthew chapter 25, where Jesus says, "As you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me." Right. So the question for us, you know, as we approach Christmas, as the Advent season, you know, begins to come to an end, and we begin to prepare ourselves to celebrate the birth of Christ, is to really ask ourselves, you know, how well do I know Christ? How well do I know him? How well do I recognize him? Mm-hmm. How well do I recognize him? How well do I know him when I'm here at church worshiping? But even more importantly, how well do I know him, and how much do I recognize him when I leave church in those around me? And that's the real test of faith, is recognizing the Lord, the risen Lord, standing in our midst.
Yeah, indeed. So you were telling me 40 days from St. Martin's Lent, the 11th of November to the 25th.
Mm-hmm.
And we leave people. I'm sure there are some math majors out there going, "Well, that's not 40.
Yeah.
That's 44. 30 days in November." But you leave out the Sundays.
That's right.
You take them out.
Yeah. Because the Sundays are kind of a relief from the penitential or character of the season. Because every Sunday is a solemnity, and which a solemnity doesn't mean, you know, solemn.
What does it mean?
It means important. It means extremely important.
What does feast of mean? The feast of this, the feast of that.
Well, a feast day, of course, is just simply a lower rank in the hierarchy of observances. The solemnity is the highest rank of an observance. So even Easter is the solemnity of solemnities.
Sure.
It's the highest feast day. But there are lesser feast days that are lower in rank in terms of the liturgical ordering of things. A solemnity is a required observance. We have solemnities, which many of which are holy days of obligation. There are a few solemnities that, depending on when they fall, may not necessarily be a holy day of obligation. But every Sunday, which is a solemnity, is also a holy day of obligation,
mm-hmm.
Which Catholics are expected to go to Mass and help celebrate the Mass. But feast days don't have that same degree of obligation that a solemnity does.
Right.
It's still important, but it's not as important as a solemnity.
And this year we're going to have the last Sunday of Advent being the 23rd. And then if you go to the Vigil Mass on Christmas Eve, you're going to Mass on Sunday and Monday.
That's right, yeah.
It's good for you.
Yeah, and there's, there's actually four different Masses for Christmas. Now, the average parishioner just typically goes to one of those.
Right.
But a priest is obliged to observe each of those four different Masses. So there's a Mass for the Vigil of Christmas. That's the one that would be celebrated on early Christmas Eve,
right.
The so-called children's Mass.
The 4 o'clock.
Yeah, the 4 o'clock Mass. So, and then there's the Mass at midnight. And that's oftentimes in many churches the highest and most celebratory Mass is the Mass at midnight.
Right.
And then there's a Mass. So people are familiar with kind of those two Masses, especially the midnight Mass. But then on Christmas Day, there are two other, and they're different Masses. Mm-hmm. They have their own set of propers and readings and so forth. You have a Mass early in the morning on Christmas Day, and then a Mass midday or mid-morning. And each of them have their own set of prayers. Each of them have their own set of readings, and they're all different. And they bring out these different different aspects of the Lord's Nativity. For the Christmas Masses, the Gospel readings are all, the first three are from the Gospel of Luke. And then the fourth Gospel reading is from the Gospel of John, the beautiful prologue of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And that's the last Mass of Christmas, which would be on Christmas morning, mid-morning, or later in the morning. Yeah.
James, always a pleasure. I learn a lot every time. Thanks so much. Underwriting for the Bishop's Hour is provided by Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services, a ministry of the Diocese of Sacramento. As a church-owned nonprofit founded in faith, Catholic Funeral and Cemetery Services is dedicated to providing education, support, and resources during life's most difficult moments. They will make every effort to enable you to realize your final wishes while empowering families to make completely informed decisions. You can give them a call. They're at 855-525-2285. That's 855-525-2285. We're also brought to you by a generous grant from Christine Cipperly, marriage and family therapist. If you're looking for help with family or personal problems, if you'd like help from someone with a Catholic point of view, someone who understands the importance of marriage and family and affirms the dignity of every human life, Christine Cipperly is a trained and experienced counselor of married couples, families, and individuals. She can work with you on your marriage, your parenting, or your individual struggles in a way that will not violate our faith. Christine is a wonderful, wonderful therapist. Give her a call. She's at 530-400-4757. That's 530-400-4757. We'd like to thank Christine Cipperly and Catholic Cemeteries and Funeral Services for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour. That's going to do it for us for today. Thanks for listening, everyone. God bless. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento.
to the cross I look, and to the cross I cling. Of its suffering I do drink, of its work I do sing. On it my Savior, both bruised and crushed, showing that God is love and God is just.